Do I think that commercial property is as defensive an asset class as I used to? Because I've often said publicly that I think commercial property is amongst the very best property, in my view, the best asset class, and it does have some quite defensive characteristics, but it hasn't with this COVID crisis. It hasn't been really terribly defensive at all in this circumstance. I still do love commercial property, and I particularly love industrial property, but I acknowledge that in all circumstances, it's not going to be defensive. It is, after all, an ownership asset. That is, it's an equity asset. And when you get something like this COVID crisis, which I must admit I never really anticipated, what I didn't anticipate was almost a complete closing down of business in the country. And the impact that that would have on commercial property. Because you've got a situation where tenants, the businesses of commercial property, can't access their property. The commercial property owners can't get their rent in a lot of circumstances. And therefore, the banks, the mortgagees of the commercial property, can't get their interest. And it's a very difficult question, and something which I think will be addressed in the upcoming budget, of where should risk lie in this? How are we going to treat this? But there will be at least some commercial property owners, probably quite a lot, I would think, who have a hard time, and some listed property trusts, and they are all about commercial property, have already had a hard time. So that's to try and answer that question. I do still love commercial property, but I acknowledge that it's not going to be defensive in every circumstance. It's been hard because this is putting this webinar together has really made me think about how investment has changed since I've been involved, which is over 35 years. There are now an awful lot of options, and options are really good, but they do create difficulties because you have to choose between the various options. In the old days, there were hardly any options for investment. You could either take a term deposit, or if you were a really sophisticated investor and you knew what they were, you could approach a share broker and maybe buy some shares. And I look back at that share broking model in those days, and it was incredibly primitive, as was our regulation in those days. It's a completely different ball game now, and there are so many options for investors in the way that we can access various asset classes and various investing. And preparing this really reminded me of that. Second thing to say is investment is competitive. One person will get better returns than another, who will get better returns than another. And you could actually graduate that. You know, there's top here, second here, third here, fourth here. This is not a situation, investment is not a situation where everybody's a winner. And not everybody can be a winner. Some will be better, some will do better than others. And there are a lot of options about how we can go about our investments. And that's really the theme of what I'm talking today about. How do you structure your investments? What part of it do you want to do? What part are you good at? And so forth. But no matter how you go about it, there is a but. All the time, there's an objection to everyone. They're not. None of them is absolutely perfect. So you could go, for example, to a direct broker, and that'll be cheap, but you won't get a platform probably for your investments to be held on. You'll have to do the administration yourself, and you probably won't get research either. Then again, you could go to something like Sharesies, and I've just written an article about Sharesies and for interest.co.nz, and that's very good, but I don't think there's any international investments available for that. Or you could go to Hatch, and also that seems to be pretty good, but there's no New Zealand investments for it. And you can go to a full service broker, and yes, they do everything, but there is a cost. So there's a but in just about every way that you want to go about on it. How you do go about it depends on a bunch of things. It depends on who you are, how much money you have, and that's not important because more money gives you more leverage and so on. But it's important in terms of diversification. And by diversification here, I'm meaning diversification within each asset class. So imagine, for example, you had $100,000 in total to invest, and you wanted to go the direct route. That is, you wanted to buy individual shares and buy them through a broker, whether a direct broker or a full service broker. And you were going to put 20% of your money into, let's say, international equities, because that's a reasonable amount for international equities. Well, if you do that, 20% of $100,000 is $20,000. Probably at most, it lets you buy four or five different companies. Now, that's not being diversified within that asset class. There are tens of thousands of global companies, and so the way you do it does depend on the amount of money you've got. If you had $100,000 and you were going to put, sorry, if you had $1 million and you were going to put 20% in, then you've got $200,000 and you can buy a whole bunch of different companies and therefore get diversification. So who you are, how much money you've got, what you're good at, and what you like doing, and I'm going to come to that later. Whether you can do some of the research yourself, or whether you're going to completely buy it in. But I think the absolute game breaker is the amount of time, effort, and energy that you are prepared to put into this. Don't forget, this is a competitive game, and if you're going to completely DIY, do it yourself, then you're up against people who spend all day, every day, staring at a screen. So how much time, effort, and energy are you going to put into this? And these are the kinds of things that I'm going to be talking about. I'll give you my experience on them, experience over 35 years. I'll tell you as plainly as I can what I think about each one. But really, I think you've got to sit back and think, how much of this process do I want to do? Because you don't have to do the whole lot. You can simply do a part of it. And one of the things I'm going to do towards the end of the webinar is break down the investment process, all the tasks that you've got to do with an investment. And I've broken it down into four. They're doing strategy, they're investment selection, that is, choosing individual investments, the execution and the administration of investment, and the monitoring of it. And you can choose any one of those or any part of those and do it yourself if that's what you want to do. You can also completely opt out. And more and more people, I'd have to say, over the years have recognized that there's a huge body of knowledge now in investment. And for a lot of people, they're simply better to hand their money over and have a professional do it completely. I will come back to that. But before I come back to it, I hope you can see the screen now. I just need to make a couple of disclosures. First of all, I'm an authorized financial advisor. What I'm talking about today is class advice or general advice. It's not personalized advice. And my disclosure statement is available on request, free of charge, or you can also find it on my website. Secondly, I'm a board member of the New Zealand Shareholders Association. That's a fairly recent appointment. Probably my biggest role now is that I chair the Summer KiwiSaver Investment Committee. Summer KiwiSaver is Forsyth Barr's KiwiSaver offer. A product disclosure statement is available again on request and free of charge. The other thing, other disclosure I need to make is that I'm a director and a shareholder of Lifetime Income. Lifetime Income is a company that provides variable annuities to people in retirement to give them income in retirement. So these are an investment product and a life insurance product whereby you give your money to the variable annuity provider, in this case Lifetime, and you give them a lump sum and they drip feed that back, paying you for the rest of your life, no matter how long you live. So this whole do-it-yourself thing, I think, was what we used to do completely, but now I'd be very cautious of it, and I think you have to be very selective of what you do. Whenever I see a client, I'm very supportive if they want to do a part of the process or even the whole process, but they have to prove to me they're prepared to put the time, effort, and energy into it. This is something I also say to property investors for 30 odd years or longer. I've gone off and spoken to property investor groups, the Property Investor, New Zealand Property Investor Federation, and property investor associations around the country. And again, I say to them, this is not something to go into half-heartedly. This is not something going into that you can think you can simply put your money into and then go to sleep. Property investment's not like that, and neither is any other form of investment. Now, there's a spectrum on this, where at one end of the spectrum, you can decide, I don't want to do any of this. I've sold the farm, I've cashed up my KiwiSaver, I've got some funds to invest, I'm going to give it to this person and they can do the whole process for me. And I'm going to sit back and I'm going to watch over the portfolio. I'm going to look at it on the platform and I'm going to, you know, see what's in the portfolio, but I'm not actually going to do any of the management myself. At the other end of the spectrum is that you do absolutely everything. Just like in the old days when you picked up the phone and telephoned a broker and said, I want to buy some Brierley, I want to buy some Robert Jones, or whatever. And anywhere within that spectrum, from do nothing to do everything, you can fit yourself. And I will come to that because I break down the various tasks into four big bits. You pay for each bit. There's a fee for each bit. So the fee will be bigger if you do nothing. It will be less if you do everything. It won't be zero. There is always something to pay. Even that person, you know, who's going to do everything, the chances are they are going to buy and research, and they you know, if it were me, if I was going to do everything, I would be buying in quite a lot of research from the likes of a Morningstar or Seeking Alpha or The Headliner or any number of other newsletters and places where you can get where you can get information. But I keep coming back to this, that whatever you do, and I'd be very supportive of it if you do part of it, but whatever you do, remember that anonymous person sitting looking at a screen all day is the person you're trying to be, and you're competing against. So if you are going to do that, like anything which is competitive, you've got to sit back and say, so what advantage do I have? And it could be that you're going to buy small cap stocks, or it could be your advantages in tactical asset allocation. And I'll come to tactical asset allocation later. Effectively, you know, in this, you're really giving yourself a job interview. So what job do I want here, and how am I going to do it? And like any job, like any job, this Venn diagram is really good, because what you're looking at here is trying to look at three things, or ask three questions is probably a better way to put it. What do you love? What pays well? And what are you good at? And if you can get all three of those and hit that sweet spot in the middle, then you really are in clover. But they are the three questions that you really have to ask yourself. For example, if you love investment and you know you're good at it and you want to do a certain part of it, you've got to ask, well, how much money do I save by doing that part? So, for example, the monitoring of it may not save you terribly by doing the monitoring yourself. You may not save terribly much in fees there. But if you are capable of doing it, so what are you good at? And if you love doing it, and that is investment selection, that is choosing individual investments and maybe doing some of the research yourself, then that does make a good saving, and you really do hit the sweet spot with that. But I think the other thing about this is that you do have the time and you do have the passion for it. Because without that, I think you will be hard pressed to come to it with enough energy. I think the first part of it is actually simply sitting back and making a plan. So first of all, setting a goal, deciding what your asset allocation is. Talk a little bit more about that soon. Whether you're going to invest directly or through managed funds. So directly means that you'd be buying individual securities, individual shares, individual fixed interest. Going at it the other way, the indirect way or the managed fund way, you'd be buying managed funds and that, because you've got to keep coming back to, yes, you can set your asset allocation, but then within each asset class, within each type of investment, you've got to figure out a way of how you're going to fill that allocation, what you're going to put in. So if you've got 20% going to shares and you've got $1 million, so you've got $200,000, what shares are you going to buy? And that's what investment selection is about. You need to, in making your plan, think about, are you going to be active or are you going to be passive? And you might be a little bit of both. Just like in that direct versus managed funds, you could be a little bit of both. Got a lot more to say about that active versus passive in a moment. Are you going to dollar cost average? That is, have you got a lump sum, and are you going to drip feed your money in over the coming year? Or maybe you haven't got a lump sum and you're already invested and you're just going to carry on with that. But probably the key question is, what parts of this am I likely to be good at, and what parts of it do you particularly love? So if we sit back, I know that pretty much every webinar that I've done, I've talked about asset allocation, getting your investment mix right, getting the amount of risk and this is really about the amount you've got in growth assets, that is shares and property, and the amount that you've got in fixed interest and cash. So I've shown this slide before. I think several times. Conservative investor might only have 30% in shares and property, balance 50% in shares and property, gross investor 70% in shares and property. I thought to illustrate this even better, that I might just go through a little bit of my own situation. Now, I'm not going through my own situation and say follow this, because my situation, like everybody's situation, is a little bit different. But I find myself at the moment with not just one provider, but actually four. And this is not something I would advise to people. I'd normally say to them, have one, maybe two at the most. But I've got two brokers at the moment. I've got money in my KiwiSaver, and I've got. I should just tell you why I've got each one of them. I've got two brokers because they're both full service brokers, which means I pay a significant fee on that, and I don't like paying fees. You know, cheap really works for me, but there are some things that I'll spend money on. But if I go to full service broker, I get advice. Because I don't think I know everything, and I also get research, and it allows me to get into direct companies because I am an interfering sort of person who, and I'm very curious, and I do therefore I don't want to be all in managed funds. I want some of it in direct investment so that I can buy some Nike or buy some Amazon or buy some Contact Energy or buy some Ryman or what have you. And my KiwiSaver, I know, lets me into a multi-asset class fund. So I've got all of the asset classes in that, and it also gives me very good diversification within those asset classes. And the other one, I started investing in at the beginning of the year, and I'd be delighted to hear me mention it, and that's InvestNow. InvestNow is simply a platform which allows you to invest in any combination of probably about 50 different managed funds. So that gives the each of the funds gives very good diversification. It's very easy to use. I did put a couple of clients who had about $100,000 to invest, and I did put a couple of them su suggest to them invest now. But before that, I did that before I suggested it. I thought I'd better have a really good look at it myself. And the way to have a really good look at it is to put some money into it. And because if you put some money into something, you do have a good look at it. The problem with Invest Now, of course, for most people, is that you can choose from these 50 different funds, but it's very difficult to make that choice. Because we don't have a lot of information to make that choice. Now, I have that information because I've got an advisor subscription to Morningstar, and that tells me which funds are good and which funds aren't so good. So I can do that. But the average person in the street doesn't have that sort of research. I've sort of sat back and said to myself, so what am I good at and what do I like doing? So the things I'm good at, well, I think I'm good at them anyway, and I certainly like doing them, is overall strategy, tactics in terms of, oh, I don't like international shares at the moment, so I'm going to underweight my portfolio to that one. And I've got sort of an approach of saying, this is a good looking industry. I like this industry. I like automation and robotics, or I like healthcare. Now, how can I invest sensibly in that?
Sorry to interrupt. If you enjoy this content, make sure you subscribe so you do not miss the next one and hit this like button to let me know that you want more information like this. Thank you.
Some of the things I'm not so good at, so I'm kind of, if you like, outsourcing them, contracting them out, is I'm not a good seller of investments. To a fault, I tend to buy investments and keep them when I really should be taking profits much earlier. I do get a bit emotionally attached to investments, and I know I shouldn't, but sometimes we can't help ourselves. I'm not terribly good at administration, or I'm perfectly good at administration, but I don't like to do administration. So I have all my portfolios held on some kind of custodial platform. So my investments are held in custody for me, in trust for me. They're identified as mine. Nobody can run away with them or anything like that. But it means I get one document at the end of the year, and that goes off to my accountant, and I can do tax and so forth. The other thing I've got against me is that I do get quite busy at times. And that means the thing that is most likely to go first is my own looking after my own investments. And I know this, and it's, I do this to a fault, but I push my own stuff down. So again, you see, I'm not somebody who's sitting there watching the screen all day, every day. I thought I'd just show you my asset allocation as well, because I do go on about this, and you can see there that I'm running my portfolio as 45% in shares and property, and 55% in international fixed interest and New Zealand fixed interest and cash. So fixed interest and cash 55, shares and property 45. Sorry, I should have had another slide there, but I seem to have missed that. So not to worry. Now, I'm not saying any of this stuff to say to you that, follow this. This is my personal, this is where I sit personally on how much I'm doing it myself, and how much I'm not. I'd have to say also, I guess the older I get, the more I know what I don't know, and the more I am contracting out, farming out, paying a fee for more of the investment process. On the whole, I do prefer the the share broker model, because the when you go with a share broker, particularly if you've got more money, you'll be able to get the diversification. You have a lot of transparency. You can go online anytime, 24/7, and look at your account and look at your portfolio and know exactly what is in it. So if you're like I am, and you've got a socially responsible bent, you can have a look at the your account, and if the broker has put some Sky City in, for example. I personally don't like gambling. If I saw that, I would call up and ask for it to come out. And I do like direct, that is being a direct investor, knowing exactly what it is. The problem with the full service broker model, or even a direct broker model, is that you really need about 300,000 minimum to get really good diversification. Because again, if you had 20% going to international shares, that's, if you had $300,000, that's $60,000. To get good diversification, you'd probably have to own some funds in there. The whole active versus passive debate is a very interesting one, particularly when you come to New Zealand. I'm going to leave that slide up there, because these guys are obviously pretty active in their in investing. I have a strong bias towards, in fact, I'm probably understating that. I like active investment versus passive, and I especially like active investment within the New Zealand share market. So Mercer does has done a study every 5 years since 2006, and what they have shown very clearly is that the average fund manager beats the market in New Zealand, beats the index. So if you had an index tracker lined up against even the average New Zealand equities, New Zealand share fund, the active share fund would beat the market. And that's when you sit back and actually think about it. New Zealand market's very small, it's under research, and it's therefore quite inefficient. And by inefficient, I mean that there are buying and selling opportunities within there. Also, about 50% of the New Zealand share market is made up of international share owners, and they're not as aggressive as a New Zealand fund manager or a New Zealand share broker would be, and they're not trying to get every last little penny. They're really just looking for a New Zealand New Zealand exposure. When you look at the United States, or for example, or international, it's a little bit more muddy. The average probably doesn't beat the index, but they probably, you know, don't forget that the passive fund managers also charge a fee. And from New Zealand, it's hard to buy, say, the Standard & Poor's 500 cheaply. So when Warren Buffett says just buy the Standard & Poor's, why he's saying that is that he's thinking people can buy it at 0.04, 4 basis points. And that's the cost of it, whereas you can't do that in New Zealand. I think about the cheapest you can get in New Zealand is about 0.2, 20 basis points. So an active manager doesn't have to just beat the index. He or she needs to beat the index less whatever fee the passive manager is charging. But I'd go further than that and say right at the moment, it's probably relatively easy for an active manager in the US or globally, internationally, to beat whatever their index is, because the share market since the COVID crisis started has bifurcated that. It's kind of split into two, and it's split on the one side to shares that you wouldn't want to touch with a 10-foot barge pole. And I'm thinking here of companies in tourism and travel and resorts and financials and those kinds of things, which have been had a huge hammering. They're still in the index. So if you just buy the index, you're still actually owning Delta Airlines, or if it's a New Zealand index in New Zealand. Whereas the other side of it, which are the tech and the and healthcare and consumer staples and those kinds of things, they've actually done extremely well since the COVID crisis. If you're a passive manager, then you're buying the index, you're buying all of those companies. You know, you're buying tourism and travel along with some tech and healthcare. Whereas an active manager can say, I'm not going to have a bar, I'm not going to touch any of that tourism and travel stuff. I'm only going to have the good stuff, which is tech and healthcare. So finally, just want to do a quick round of those four main tasks that we've got. First one is strategy, and strategy is most importantly asset allocation. And when I say asset allocation, you know, again, it's the percentage in shares, property, fixed interest, and cash. And that's probably somewhere between 80 and 90% of the job. If you can get your asset allocation right, if you can get the amount of risk right, then you've done a big part of the investment job. Second thing there is tactical asset allocation. So that is saying, I don't like a particular asset class because of whatever reason, ABC. And so from a point of tactics, I'm either going to underweight that or overweight. So my strategic allocation to, let's say, international equities might be 20%. But I really like international equities at the moment, so I'm going to actually have 25% in them, or I really don't like them, so I'm only going to have 15% in. So we're making tactical decisions. And when we get into this whole active-passive debate, everybody assumes that it's only about investment selection. That is, should I just have all of the index, or can I pick particular companies within that index? But it's not only about that, and it's also about what tactical decisions would I make. Strategy also comes down to directs or funds, and that often comes down to how much diversification you want, and therefore how much money you have, or whether you're like me and you're an interfering and curious sort of person who does like to have some individual companies. I personally adopt a both to that. I do have some funds. For example, the KiwiSaver, my KiwiSaver. Another example would be the things I've got in InvestNow are funds. Active versus passive, I've already covered. And of course, you know, you really do need some criteria for selling, which is something that I, to my shame, really struggle with. And I know a lot of people put stop losses on there. You know, when they buy shares, they'll put a, say, 10% below what they pay, they'll put a stop loss, which means that the shares get sold if they fall to 10% below what they paid for them. And of course, in selling, that crystallizes a loss. But there is an old investment saying which says something like, cut your losses, but let your profits run. Second one is investment selection. So this is choosing what particular investments, how you're going to fill each of those asset classes. And you need to make a decision on this, whether you'll be very diversified or quite high conviction. So, for example, again, if 20% of your portfolio is going into international equities, will you have a huge number of them? So you could buy a couple of funds and you would probably have exposure to maybe 2,000 different securities, 2,000 different companies. Or are you going to own 20 companies within that, or 30 companies or something? And that's quite high. Amount of conviction. Sorry, I'm just I just flicked over a page there accidentally. You do have to, in making your investment selection, you do have to look at liquidity, value, future prospects, people involved. One thing you've got to remember in this is that you can have a very good company, but it may not prove to be a good investment because you haven't assessed value properly, or its future prospects may not be terribly good. Execution administration. Obviously, you've got to do the buying and selling. So some people are doing this on, say, an ASB securities and doing this very cheaply. But I really like I was going to say new, it's probably actually 15 or 20 years old, this whole thing of having the portfolio held in custody on a platform. So a custodial platform means that the securities, whether they're shares, whether they're fixed interest, whether they're funds, are held on that platform, and you can look at them any time of the day or night, 24/7. You can have a look at them and see, you know, how they're doing, how they've done. You can see what proportions you've got, so you know your asset allocation at a glance, because the platform, the custodial platform, will say you now have $250,000 in international shares, in which case you might think, oh, that's a bit much, I'm meant to have $200,000, I think I'll sell down some of those and put them into something else. And I talked before about the tax information, and I do love that, because the old days you used to get a dividend check for $4.50 or something, and you have to take that check to the bank and bank it and so forth, and then you get a piece of paper, and all these bits of paper would have to go off to the accountant to show what dividends that you have. And then finally, you've got the whole monitoring process, and you've got to monitor, obviously, individual investments. And the an advisor who I know and who I have a lot of time for, he's a very good advisor, said that the days of simply buy and hold are gone. And I think he's right. I'm not terribly good at the gone part, and I'm terribly good at the selling part of that. But that old thing of you just buy it and just hold it forever. There's very few companies that I would put in the in that category now. You've got to monitor your asset allocation. So if one asset class of your international shares gets too much in it or too little in it, you've got to sell, you've got to trim, bring it back. Otherwise it can get out of your what you set as your asset allocation. You've got to monitor your performance. Now that's actually quite hard to do because you'd think that'd be fairly easy, and the custodial platform probably tells you that this year you've made 6.4% after your fees, and that's okay. But then, what has everybody else made, and what has everybody else who is running a balanced portfolio made? So, am I doing better than a conservative? Because you've got to risk adjust this whole thing. And finally, monitoring probably also does mean some stop losses. Just want to finish up. I started with a question somebody had asked. I also had a question midweek in preparation for this. So just before I hand over to Helen and we have some questions. Somebody asked about a firm called Interactive Brokers. Now, I'd have to say I hadn't heard of them. I went online and had a look at their website, and they looked to me like a direct brokerage house and are therefore very cheap. And maybe that would be a good way to buy if you had research, and this person had Morningstar research, so that's good. They may want more research from somewhere else as well. But once you've got that research, and if you knew what you were going to populate your, let's say, your international shares allocation, then you could use someone like that. The only thing he was asking for what fish hooks I could see, and the thing I'd be quite concerned about that would be, first of all, I don't know what the regulation system in the US is. I'm assuming that Interactive Brokers are a US company, and I also think that if excuse me, if something went wrong, how would you get on suing them? And what would that sort of legal action against them be like? One of the things I do really like about New Zealand now, not so much 2 or 3 decades ago, but now we have very well regulated financial markets. I think the Financial Markets Authority, the FMA, is doing a very, very good job in regulating our markets. Not always perfect. Not necessarily picking up bad eggs, and bad eggs will always exist in every industry and every profession. But I think they're doing a very good job of regulation. So with that, I'll hand back to you, Helen, and I think you'll probably ask for questions, and I'll have a wee sip of water.
Brilliant, thanks. Right. Yes, we've got a lot of questions. Okay, our first one, you were just talking before about the custodial platform, made a few mentions of that. So to have a custodial platform, do you need to be with a broker as opposed to a DIY investor?
Yeah, so I didn't make that clear. The answer to that is yes. You don't have to be with a broker because financial advisors who aren't brokers and who manage money for people, they have access to them. And InvestNow has access to them. Hatch and Sharesy, I think, have access to them. But if you were going to be a complete DIY investor, like in the old days, you wouldn't have X is 2-1. I don't think, in fact, I'm sure I'm right on this. ASB Securities, for example, you don't have access to it. So, you know, in the old days, and I'm talking about the early 1980s here, so really back in the olden days, you know, I used to buy a share and I would have a big, you know, big bit of paper and I would write down what I'd bought and what I paid for it, and then I'd cross that out and write in what the value was now and so on. And I was having to do that manually, just about with an abacus, with just with bits of paper. And all the time, because we were getting a new price on the shares, having to cross that price out and say, well, I've got 200 of those, and instead of being $4.20 now, it's $4.35. So working out the new value and then looking and seeing what the portfolio was. So that was the days before computer was. Now, if your money is held on custody, on a platform, and it's held in custody, you can see this that at a glance, maybe not quite in real time, but maybe they are. I've never actually taken any notice whether they're adjusting the shares as they trade. I'm not sure about that, but you can certainly see it on a 24-hour basis, and you'll have a pretty clear idea of not just what your total value of your portfolio is, but the components, the parts of it. So how much now is the value of my international shares? How much now is the value of my listed property? I don't think there's any way that I know of that a completely DIY investor could have one of those.
Great, thank you. We've had a number of questions in different incarnations about the cost of working with a professional, with a broker, with a financial advisor. How do people know what is reasonable?
Yeah, I was afraid that was the question. I can remember a friend of mine who's dearly departed now. Used to say, if you think that dealing with a professional is expensive, wait till you deal with an amateur. That's very, you know, there are a bunch of things with markets and finance, as complicated as they are now, and so many different offers, so many different options, where it's very difficult to know whether you're getting value for money. What I suppose I would say is that a financial advisor, you know, and whether that's a big share broking firm or whether it's a smaller group of financial planners, they ought to give returns which are in excess of their fees. Now, making that calculation is really difficult. So if let's say in the last 12 months we knew that the average KiwiSaver balance fund had, after fees, only after fees, ignore tax for a minute, had produced 8.2%, then you would want to be using a financial advisor as a broker. You would want to be getting something pretty close to that, because that's kind of setting a benchmark. There's a Morningstar every quarter, and they've just done one, put out a survey of the returns of the different KiwiSavers, and that sets out each of, they don't quite cover all of the KiwiSaver funds, but the vast majority of them, and they're giving the returns for the last year, the last 3 years, the last 5 years, the last 10 years for each category of funds. So if you're running your money as a growth investor, for example, you can look at the other growth funds and see what your performance is compared to the average KiwiSaver, and that's useful. just do be very careful that you're comparing apples with apples, because I'm pretty sure those Morningstar ones are after fees and after tax, whereas your ones might be simply after fees. In fact, they may not even be after that. So do just make sure, you know, if you're with a financial advisor, that financial advisor should be reporting on a quarterly basis what your performance is. And they should be able to say you are a growth investor, and this was your return for that quarter. You should be able to look up and see how that compares with, say, a particular fund.
Right, thanks, Martin.
It's complicated, isn't it? It's not, none of this has got easy anymore. It's got ever increasing layers of complexity. And I'm very supportive of people doing this by themselves, but I know that it does get tricky.
Absolutely. You spoke about a question about asset allocation. So you spoke about that earlier in the presentation. Do you think that people should have a sector allocation component to their portfolio?
Yeah, what a good question. Really good question. And I do not, I actually do with my own portfolios, not in a formal sense, but in a, you know, I tend to keep this in the head. So what I'm pretty sure the questioner is getting at here is let's go back to that global shares allocation. And we've got $200,000, 20% going into that, which is for $1 million portfolio. That's $200,000 going into that. Do you break that down into sectors? So I do. You know, I like to think, you know, that I've got a fair proportion. I couldn't tell you of my own portfolio right now what my proportion in the health sector is at the moment, or the tech sector. I could work it out. I hope I've got very little in the finance or travel or tourism sector. Yes, I do get very keen on particular sectors. In fact, I ran one of these webinars, I think it was at webinar 3, Helen, I think, on sort of the big trends, and that was breaking things down to what are the good and what are the bad sectors. So I'm very keen on that, and I personally am happy to concentrate to one, two, or three sectors, a fair bit of my money, not completely. You know, I'm happy to own a little bit of all of the S&P 500, Standard & Poor's, it's the top 500 companies in the United States. So I've got a little bit of everything in there, but most of my portfolio is in fact targeted to tech, or it's targeted to healthcare, or whatever else I might think it was good at any particular time.
Yeah, they're interesting times, aren't they? When you see virtually an entire industry, you know, wiped out, really.
You can. I'm very interested that Warren Buffett, and I knew he did this, that they had three airlines in his portfolio. Now, he sold them all now. And he's given abject apologies and you know that he'll never do it again. But his mentor, a man by the name of Ben Graham, wrote as early as the 1940s a book called The Intelligent Investor. It's still in print. It's a wonderful book. But Ben Graham used to talk about then just don't buy airlines. And I'm pretty sure I've heard Warren Buffett say, don't buy airlines. And I was astonished to see him have three airlines in there, because the airline industry is a very fickle and a very brittle industry, a bit like tourism itself, actually. But, you know, it's no easy business model taking a 100-ton flying machine and flying it to the other side of the world with cargo on it and people on it and so forth. There's all sorts of things that can go wrong. Just from an operational point of view, before you get to the finances of it and the marketing of it. And, you know, I think you know, basically in New Zealand got a $900 million bailout last week, and I think that's the third time in my lifetime they've gone broke. Certainly the second, but I think it is actually the third time they've been broke. And airlines do that all the time. Why Warren Buffett would have gone into airlines is, I think it's very unlike him.
Risky business. Hey, one more question before we wrap up for this afternoon. We have a number of new and novice investors with us this afternoon. If you were a novice investor, so if you take yourself back a couple of years, so when you were starting out, what advice would you give to them now? Like, what should we do next? Where should we get information?
I'd read as much as I could, but ultimately you learn by doing. So I'd watch very carefully what my KiwiSaver is doing. I'd read what they are putting out. I'm assuming that they tell you what they're doing and that they are putting stuff that you can read. So I'd be trying to watch that in real time and work out how they do that. And I've taken a very deep breath before I say this, but ultimately there's no alternative to putting a bit of your money on the line. And I'd start very small, even if you've got more money than you have available. I'd start with small amounts of money and invest it. And if that means that you need to go to Sharesies or you need to go to Hatch, then so be it. But I think the sooner you can get alongside a really good financial advisor / share broker type, the better, really, and that you understand why these people are buying this and why they're selling it. You really do learn in this by doing it. And I've been doing it since 1981 or 82 or something. I was 12 at the time. And you know, this is the fourth crash that I've lived and invested through. I guess I could say I was lucky in so far as before I had too much money in the share market, the 1987 crash came along, and that was very hurtful for me. I lost, even though I didn't have all that much money in it by today's standards, it was quite a lot for me in those days, and it hurt very much to lose that. And a lot of that money was lost permanently. But it did teach me, it taught me that bad stuff does happen. Because we'd had, up until that, we'd had 10 or 15 years, I don't know how long, of very good investment weather, a very good investment times. And I thought really stupidly, like really stupidly, that this time is different and this time it's just going to sail on forever into the never never. This time is never different. The good times always end, and they always end with something like what we're going through now. So just if you've lost a little bit of money in the last wee while, just remember how that felt for the rest of your life. And whenever you make, you know, carry on making investments, don't let it put you off. But just remember that these times come along every decade or so now, seemingly. In a couple of years' time, if you put your money into some shares, or you have money in the share market, just remind yourself constantly that it's never different, and markets go up, but they also come down.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this content, I appreciate if you leave your honest review on any podcast app. It helps me to improve my next episode, or you can simply request any topic for me to research. Do you know any friend that may benefit from this information? Please forward this podcast to them. Otherwise, stay tuned because more good stuff coming soon. Thank you.